We have spent the last two episodes talking about the super spectacle films of Italy. These movies, like The Inferno, Quo Vadis, and Cabiria, get a just amount of attention, in the same way that the famous giant sequoia trees of California really do deserve all the attention they get. There's no denying that seeing something unusually large, elaborate, or expensive really can be spectacular, in every sense of that word. But anyone who's ever been to a forest can tell you that there's more than one kind of tree worth looking at. The small ones are beautiful too, though you may miss their beauty if you go to the woods only looking for the biggest or the grandest tree. I can feel this metaphor breaking apart as I'm using it, so I think it's time to stop. But suffice it to say that the Quo Vadises and Cabirias were not the only early Italian films worth looking at then, just as the Avengers and the Godzillas are not the only movies worth looking at from the United States today. The smaller, more quickly forgotten movies are also important, and they can tell us a lot about the industry and culture that created them. So that's what we're going to do today. Looking past the giant sequoias and at the smaller trees that live in their shadow. Still now, well, it was worth a try. This is the 22nd episode of the History of Film, Italian Futurism, and everything else.
No story ever written for the screen is as dramatic as the story of the screen itself.
Back in episode 14, we saw the beginnings of the studio system in the United States. There, guided by the ever-loving and paternal hand of Thomas Edison and his trust, moviemaking took on an industrial quality, a factory-like approach that rarely lended itself much to the making of art, but instead to the art of making money. This is what many of us still think about when we talk about the studio system, big movie factories that look only at the bottom line. In Italy, however, the systems for film production developed differently. According to Italian film historian Gian Piero Brunetta, Italian studios were more like, well, studios. He describes Italian film production companies as having an artisanal tradition of the Renaissance workshop. The studios making films in Italy had different ways of doing things, different priorities, and different structures that were used to actually make movies happen. Writer and lecturer Joseph Luzzi says that this tradition can be described as having certain qualities of the amateur and the idiosyncratic, and it was just these qualities that would lead to Italian film becoming very creatively productive. These qualities ended up being both a good and a bad thing for Italian film of this period. The kinds of movies that could be made in a less centralized system of production could often have a lot of room for creativity and experimentation, which is good. Unfortunately, competition from much more organized systems of production, like those in Hollywood, would soon be able to outcompete Italian films in their home market. And that's bad. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The production of Italian silent film isn't in decline yet, so let's talk about these special studios in the artisanal tradition of the Renaissance workshop and see how they made movies. Most of the production companies that appeared in early Italian film never reached the amazing heights of Cines or Italia, who produced the giant films we talked about last episode. No, most of the 867 production companies, that is the real number, which existed in Italy in 1910, were cheap, fly-by-night affairs. The new business of film production attracted young entrepreneurs, often without the capital necessary to actually make movies or make money off of them. Though some would make it through this chaos of creation, most of these small production companies went bankrupt. Still, this gives us an idea of how the idiosyncratic nature of Italian studios began. How could it not? There were almost 1,000 production companies. And out of the ashes of these small producers came something surprising. Investment. Nobles, landowners, and industrialists saw the potential for Italian cinema to make money at home and abroad. The influx of money from their investment allowed some studios to thrive. In 1911, three companies would produce a staggering 60% of all movies made in Italy, including all four movies which ran for more than an hour. If you were a filmmaker in Italy, it must have seemed like these major studios stood like Moloch from Cabiria, commanding, consuming, and gilded with gold. But even these gigantic studios inherited something of the youth and what we could call chaotic vitality, which we saw in the glut of studios in the years before. Let's go back to the hypothetical from a minute ago. Imagine you are a person working in an Italian studio between 1911 and 1915. What is that like for you? Well, there are a few things you would notice. First, your coworkers and even your bosses are young. Most people working in the industry were less than 30 years old. This was just as true for directors as it was for technicians. Another thing you may notice is the whole idea of coworker and boss was fluid. As film historian Pierre Solon describes it, the same person could alternatively write, shoot, direct, and act. And then he remarks that there was a permanent competitive spirit in the studios. That makes it sound to me like the system was relatively open to talent and ambition. That is a little bit of conjecture on my part, but as far as I can tell, that is the case. And as for those scripts, utter garbage. No good, never watch. Well, at least according to Pierre Solon, who wrote, "Amateurism was especially obvious in the preparation of scripts. Clever schemes or fancy ideas, hastily written down, were circulated to a few people who added beautiful, gripping scenes, but did not care about the coherence of the whole story. Looking for money, one filmmaker told his producer, 'I could prepare a project in a few days.'" Now, to be fair to Solon, and to protect him from my funny voice, he does say that his descriptions of the studios and their product aren't intended to detract from them, but he doesn't seem to have a lot of praise for them either. C'est la vie. So let's take a look at the kind of crummy scripts Solon was definitely not detracting from. The example that, like, every Italian film history writer ever references for these kinds of screenplays is actually from a 1915 novel by Luigi Pirandello, entitled Shoot in English. In the novel, the movie everybody is working on writes its climactic scene to be the killing of a real live tiger, because the local zoo has a tiger set to be executed. If the tiger is going to be killed anyway, might as well shove it in the movie, am I right? Now, that scenario was fictional from a novel, but the situation is accurate. Italian films of this period tended to take exciting things and put them in the movie, thinking of story afterwards. And, believe it or not, we've already seen some of it. If any of you watched Cabiria, you know that a lot of stuff happens in Cabiria. And I mean just stuff. Elephants, human pyramids, love triangles that are only barely related to the characters the film asks us as the audience to care most about. Stuff. And while Cabiria is much more grounded in time, theme, and story than many other films that were coming out at this period, it does feel a bit like writer-director Giovanni Pastorone thought of a bunch of cool stuff to put in a movie first, and then wrote a story around it. Such was the way. Leaving screenplays and heading back to the studios, something I have no information about even to make a guess on is the place that women had in these early Italian studios. I know of at least one woman who was an important working director in Italian film, who we will talk about later in this episode, but as for the troops on the ground, it remains unclear. Something I do know is that if we simply assumed women did not participate in the events they were not recorded in, it would mean that women missed most of history. So we'll leave this one at an I'm not sure. And if any of you listening out there do know where I can find a book about women working in early Italian film studios, please let me know. As these early studios produced their movies, genres and new forms of film marketing developed. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Italy quickly developed its own star system, similar to the one we saw grow back in the United States in episode 16. This star system would be known as divismo, and in many ways would become the defining characteristic of Italian film from this period. DeVismo is more than just the love and fascination with movie stars that we're familiar with today. In books written about this part of film history, DeVismo is often described as having a quasi-religious aspect to it. Listen to this description by scholar Jacqueline Reich, author of The Maciste Films of Italian Silent Cinema. Quote, "Cinema became a sacred site of popular culture and created its own ritual, film-going, sites of worship, theaters, and gods, the divas, as objects of devotion. Just as the extra-cinematic discourse can mythologize actors into divine creatures, myths and rituals can also be the spontaneous expression of the masses." These religious overtones aren't a post-facto reading by scholars either, they're baked in. Even the word diva translates to goddess. I don't want to overstate this, or make the Italian people of this period seem strange. The kind of devotion many people felt all over the world to movie stars in the early days of film would seem alien to most of us now. But I also don't want to understate it either, because DeVismo really was that big of a deal. Beginning about 1910, the glamour of the diva, or the Italian female star, would be the primary draw to the movie theater for many people. The term DeVismo and diva were borrowed from the world-famous Italian opera, where they were originally applied to stage sopranos, but the terms really exploded in popularity as the movies became the new popular form of entertainment. There were, of course, male stars, but the real money and the real fame was in the women of the Italian screen. The divas of the early 19-teens usually appeared in specific kinds of movies. Films of high society, melodrama, love affairs, and for most people, unimaginable glamour and excess. As one writer would put it, the diva films were a self-portrait, willed or not, of an era, of a world, devoted to extravagance and cynicism as ours is to eroticism and violence. That is perhaps a little harsh, but point taken. The divas were not relatable, that was the point of them. They were, according to Jacqueline Reich, untouchable and otherworldly. They were representations of forbidden passions and a newfound desire for social mobility. There were about 10 of the great divas, but we're only going to talk about two of them. Francesca Bruttini was born Elena Sericini Vitilio on the 5th of January, 1892. And as a star, made her way in the world using only her face. A combination of her amazing capacity to express something just by modifying her facial features and the somewhat plastic way she would move her body made her pretty much the platonic idea of what a silent motion picture star was. When I say plastic, I mean a combination of sharp and slow movements, like in her movie Satanic Rhapsody from 1915, in which she'll reach out or take a step with an almost jerky movement and then slowly follow through, bringing her other leg forward or caressing a person's face with a languid stroke. Chances are, if any of you have ever pretended to be an overdramatic silent film actor, you've probably been doing an exaggerated impression of Francesca Bertini, or someone acting in her same style. And that's not ridiculous, I bet all of you have done that, it's not just me. Bertini just exudes a high-class over-the-topness, and makes the camera and audiences look at her otherworldly movements for long periods of time. Lyda Borelli was born on the 22nd of March, 1884, in Genoa. As far as her film persona is concerned, she was, according again to Pierre Solin, sort of the opposite of Bertini, but in a good way. This is his description. Borelli made use of her entire body. She was slim, graceful, and supple. She could, in one movement, turn round on herself, cross a room, jump onto a sofa. She tossed her head back briskly, then remained idle for a long moment, delicately quivering, and finally vanished into some corner. Despite being a little odd, that really is an excellent description of Borelli. She's an amazing physical actor. I would actually say that her style leans towards the naturalistic and looks forward to the silent acting that would become more prominent in the United States in the 1920s. She could, for example, lean over a bed and clutch a child's pillow, revealing a world of internal feeling through wordless body movement, I try and always see movies in their historical context and give them all of the benefit of the doubt that I can, but honestly, Pirelli doesn't really need that. Her acting holds up, and she shows amazingly what silent actors could do. We could go on, but hopefully you get the idea. Each of the divas were unique, bringing different aspects of acting and character to the movies they were in. They usually starred in dramatic roles, and were icons of wealth and prestige, who were adored by the men and women of Italy throughout the 1910s. If the historical films from last episode are the most remembered kinds of movies from this period of Italian film, then the Divismo films are just below the surface. They loom as the largest giants who are still far too often excluded from general film histories. But of course, there were more than actors working in film at this time. There were also, believe it or not, directors. Some we've already met, like Giovanni Pastorone, director of Cabiria, whose enigmatic life we had such trouble talking about last episode. And with directors, just like the divas, we could talk about many of them. But we will restrict ourselves, once again, to talking about two, whose lives I at least find particularly interesting and instructive. And the first of these directors is the man with the fabulously easy to pronounce name, Roberto Roberti. Roberto Roberti was born in the town of Torella dei Lombardi on the 24th of July, 1879. If you assume that a name like Roberto Roberti is too silly to be his real name, you would be, in this case, correct. Sadly, his actual name is boring old Vincenzo Leone. Roberti was a fairly prolific director, with a career lasting decades. His last film, The Mad Merceiro, was released in 1952, an impressive 39 years after his first film, The Tower of Terror, was released in 1913. He worked with many of the most famous and prominent actors of this period, including Francesca Bertini in one of her most famous roles, entitled The Serpent from 1920. Of greatest interest to us, though, is his work on the 1913 Western, Indian Vampires, a film which is now lost, and was very likely the first Western ever made in Italy. Italy, as it turns out, would later develop an important national tradition for the genre. And just so you know, that is an incredible understatement. It is also worth noting that Roberti's son, Sergio Leone, would follow his father and his mother, who was a film actress, into their profession and become a director himself. I find it really interesting that the man who helped create the genre of the Western in Italy had a son who would become one of the greatest influencers on that genre's development, but that's a story for like 300 episodes from now. The next director we're going to talk about is the big one. In fact, the biggest one. According to her entry in the ever-wonderful Women Film Pioneers Project, she is, quote, now celebrated as Italy's first and most prolific film director. Can we please get a round of applause for the director of over 60 feature films, who also wrote, produced, distributed, and acted in who knows how many movies, the amazing Elvira Notari. Elvira Cotta was born in the city of Salerno on the 10th of February, 1875. Her youth was one of academics and education, attending a school of science until moving with her family to Naples. It was in this new home city that she would encounter the man she would marry and the profession she would become so deeply involved with. The man was Niccolò Notari, whose last name she would take upon marriage and make all of her films under. The profession was photography, soon to become filmmaking. Elvira was married in 1902, and in 1905, the young couple opened their own photographic studio, specializing in color prints. In 1912, their studio, now called Dora Film, transitioned to become a full-fledged motion picture production company. Niccolò Notari would operate the camera, and Elvira would write and direct the films. Her exacting standards would earn her the nickname The General from those who worked with her. To give you an idea of just how demanding The General could be, Notari refused to let any of her actors use fake tears. She wouldn't even let them use chemical means of stimulating their tear ducts. Instead, she would, and I quote, bring up a painful or emotionally sensitive episode or detail of a player's private life until an emotional response was achieved. Then she would order the camera to roll. Whoa, harsh. Her films had an emphasis on realism. She would hire non-professional actors, like a schoolteacher, to play a low-class femme fatale, something that was uncommon in the days that the diva films ruled Italian cinema. In her search for realism, she began a school for actors and directors, in which she would emphasize naturalistic acting over theatrical movement. The films that Notari directed were often full of violence, revenge, and prison life. In a word, melodrama. Or she would make dramas typically directed to be appealing to middle-class women. In other words, she's an early precursor to the film realism that Italy would become famous for. Notari found success in Italy and in the United States, where her films, some in the style we just described and some based on Italian stage shows, were popular with communities of Italian immigrants. And while she would make 60 feature films between 1912 and 1930, she would eventually be forced out of the Italian film industry. There were a few factors which eventually caused this. Censorship was likely the biggest one. One of her films, A Centinote from 1922, featured depictions of child abuse, including a man dragging his daughter by her hair, something that was considered too inappropriate for Italian or American audiences. Whether it was depictions of alcohol abuse, violence, or anything else deemed to be unacceptable by film censors, Notari's films weren't able to make their way to audiences as often as she would have liked, which is a problem when your business depends on, you know, actually selling the movies you make. In response to this censorship, Notari would direct a sound musical in the Hollywood style in 1928, but it was poorly received. The rise of fascism back in Italy made the censorship standards even more stringent. In 1930, Dora Films closed its doors permanently, and Notari would leave the film industry. I wish I could describe some of her movies for you, but as far too often is the case when plumbing the depths of film history, I really can't find them. There are records of a 2007 restoration of A Centinote, but it appears to be inaccessible to me, and I mean, come on, I would pay for it, but alas, it is not to be. Hopefully, in the future, her movies will become more available so we can talk about them. But until then, we have to make do with what we can read about her career and the few clips that are available on the internet. So far, on this Everything Else episode of The History of Film, we've looked at studios, actors, and directors in Italy. That's pretty good, but we're not done yet, because we now come to a film movement, something that will be incredibly important to the history of film going forward. With the possible exception of the Brighton School we talked about in episode 8, and even then, only if you squint a little, Italian Futurism will be the first film movement that we've ever encountered in our journey through film history. So, before we talk about what that is, we first need to talk about what a film movement is in the first place. This is how the term film movement is defined in Oxford's A Dictionary of Film Studies. Quote, in literature and the arts, a movement is a group that shares similar ideas about style, aesthetics, or cultural and political objectives, and agrees on methods of furthering these. In cinema, a number of movements have emerged this way, from declared artistic and political goals of filmmakers. In other words, it's when a group of film people talk about and make movies in similar ways for similar reasons, whatever those reasons may be. Perhaps most famously, a bunch of young people in Paris in the 1950s and 60s generally agreed on all of the reasons they thought French film was boring, and worked together to make movies that they all thought would be less boring using many of the same techniques. This was a conscious film movement, which has become known as the French New Wave. We can see the same kind of thing happening in Italy in the 1910s before the outbreak of the First World War. Here, a bunch of people thought that movies like Cabiria and Quo Vadis looked back too fondly on Italy's past. Italy, they thought, had an even more glorious future ahead of it. Welcome to the stage, the Italian Futurists. Futurism was born in 1909, from the mind of one Filippo Tommaso Marinetti. Marinetti, according to his own tale, landed on the idea of futurism after driving his automobile as fast as he could, falling into a factory ditch, and then speeding onward through the night, covered in mud and refuse. The feeling of power, manliness, speed, and aggression that he felt as he drove his car made him come to the understanding that the lazy good-for-nothings who wrote poetry about lame things like love, nature, or suffering were just making the world lame, so he decided to do something about it. Encourage people to create art that was as cool and macho and powerful as cool guys driving cool race cars. He published these ideas in what he called the Manifesto of Futurism in a Paris newspaper called Le Figaro. Hopefully you could hear some contempt in my voice as I talked about this, because I am, of course, making no attempt to hide how stupid I think this is. But I'm not misrepresenting his arguments. Here are some of the real tenets of the movement as expressed in his original manifesto in 1909, and I quote, "We declare that the splendor of the world has been enriched by a new beauty, the beauty of speed. A racing automobile with its bonnet adorned with great tubes like serpents with explosive breath, a roaring motor car which seems to run on machine gun fire, is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace. We want to sing of the man at the wheel, the ideal axis which crosses the earth, itself hurled along its orbit. We are on the extreme promontory of the centuries. What is the use of looking behind at the moment when we must open the mysterious shutters of the impossible? Time and space died yesterday. We are already living in the absolute, since we have already created eternal, omnipresent speed." Like, what is that even supposed to mean? There's nothing wrong with liking cars and speed, but it's like it was written by some sort of crazy AI who was fed only speeches by Mussolini and music by the Beach Boys. And the speed part's a little weird and easy to tease, but there's also, like, a scary part. In addition to promoting this sense of macho-ness by driving cars or whatever, Marinetti and the futurists wanted to promote their philosophy by attacking anything that wasn't, in their eyes, properly powerful, industrial, or masculine. Here's what they wrote. "We want to glorify war, the only hygiene for the world. We want to glorify militarism, patriotism, and the destructive gesture of the anarchists, the beautiful ideas which kill, and contempt for women. We want to demolish museums and libraries, fight morality, feminism, and all opportunist and utilitarian cowardice." That, my friends, is a big yikes. To modern ears, the love of macho-ness, mechanical power, and self-described contempt for women raises some pretty bright red flags that this movement would end up becoming important to the upcoming Italian fascist movement. But at the time, it resonated with a lot of Italian artists. The futurists thought that many Italian artists and people focused too much on the ancient glories of Rome, and that this past-centeredness was preventing Italy's rise to future greatness, and that industrial might, mechanization, sheer manly power, and war were the only ways that Italy and Italians could achieve a mighty and brilliant future. Italian futurism was a general art movement. It found its way into painting, poetry, and literature, but there was another, newer art form that must have seemed perfect to the futurists: film. Cinema was the first popular art that was essentially industrial and mechanical in nature. In a very real way, it had all of the wheels and cogs that the futurists found so interesting, and in what I'm sure was an added benefit, cameras and projectors do seem to run on machine gun fire. It was a match made in heaven. Well, the prophet of this new philosophy, Marinetti, didn't really feel that way, but we'll talk about that soon. For now, let's talk about the one still existing Italian futurist film, Dias. Because there's only so much biography the human mind can take in an hour, I will spare you the life story of Anton Guaio Bragaglia, and I swear that is how it's written, I'm sorry if that's not how it's pronounced, who was the man who wrote and directed Dias, a futurist film which was released in 1917. The plot of Dias is actually pretty simple. A foreign seductress named Vera Preobrajenska, who I will refer to as Vera for the rest of the episode for obvious reasons, is courting the attentions of various married men. One day, her eyes land on the lover of her closest friend, a countess. Upon hearing that the object of her affection had betrayed her, the countess falls off her horse and dies. In regret, Vera decides to kill herself and enters a nightmare-like mechanical room to accomplish her goals. Okay, so far, mostly so normal. There were plenty of diva films from this same period, which just as easily could have used this melodramatic plot. Upper-class melodrama, after all, was the backbone of the diva films. But there are a few aspects about this movie in particular, like that mechanical room, that make it stand out as a futurist film. These can be pretty easily broken down into two categories, the film's impressive visuals and its plot. So let's tackle one and then the other. The first thing to note about Thias' visuals is that, for the most part, they are hard to see. At least, they're hard to see now. The only print that I can find is in poor shape, and parts of it are completely indecipherable. Still, for most of it, you can get a general idea of what the movie looks like, and for the first two-thirds of it, it looks pretty normal. The camera moves a bit, there are some close-ups, people walking, riding horses, pretty normal stuff. But the last 5 minutes or so are jarring. All of a sudden, the audience is thrust out of the natural, normal world they've been in into a distinctly created and unnatural world. The shades of gray that populate the rest of the film are replaced with strictly delineated black and white. All of the sets are painted with geometric designs, and a massive white grid separates Vera from the screen. Eventually, the audience sees a strange pipe in the center of 10 black and white squares, decreasing in size to make a stripe pattern across the wall. Gas pours from it, and Vera begins to suffocate, moving through the surreal, unnatural, man-made world until she dies. In the middle of it, massive spikes protrude from the ground and the walls around her, which she makes a long and arduous attempt to struggle through. It's a tough ending for Vera, though it is a visually stunning one. And it shows a lot of things futurism would be known for. In its dynamic, climactic scene, everything is industrial, constructed, unnatural, and if I do say so myself, shows some contempt for at least the woman on the screen. If the goal was to bring the confusion and even the horror of the modern industrial world to the screen, I think the filmmakers succeeded. I mean, I didn't feel like I was driving a race car while I was watching it, but I did feel something, I'll tell you that. As for the plot, it isn't what we would call orthodox futurist by any means. Lucia Ray, a scholar of Italian literature, says that might have been exactly the point. Ray writes that Thias is making jabs at the whole idea of divas and melodramatic film. The director, Bragaglia, casts an unknown in the lead role, and the inner titles of the film simply tells the audience that she's an actor of great renown. By doing so, he points out that the whole idea of divas as they existed in wider Italian film was flimsy. Essentially, he says divas are only divas because we're told they are. And I can see that. And I also personally think that bringing a young diva into a futurist world that ultimately violently destroys her is like the most Italian futurist thing I can imagine. So that's how I feel. But there was someone who didn't share those feelings. The big boy of futurism, Marinetti himself. Marinetti's views on Thias were, shall we say, less than warm. From what I've read, he wasn't outright antagonistic to the film, but he didn't really think it was futurist either, and so remained unimpressed. And to be fair to Marinetti, at least on the surface, how could it be a futurist film? It's mostly about women, and doesn't even have a single race car. I mean, cars and contempt for women are two of the big futurist things. Sure, it has violent death, but where's the war, the manliness, the destruction? Come on, we can do better. But there was a futurist film that Marinetti did like, and he even helped produce it. The movie was called Vita Futurista, and it was produced and released episodically between 1916 and 1917. It didn't do very well financially. We can't say too much about it, because copies of it don't seem to exist anymore, but Vita Futurista's failure seems to have sealed the fate of the futurist film movement, which Marinetti was not all too fond of anyway. He felt that cinema lacked the possibility of audience participation that made his beloved Life Theater the perfect site for futurism to flourish. Film, he thought, was an inferior, lightweight art form for the masses, and a business for women rather than men. Without the blessing of Marinetti, Italian futurist film died in the cradle. While I myself, as I've said before, am not a huge fan of the ideas that Italian futurism was all about, I will admit their aesthetic innovations were at the very least deeply influential. One of the world's most famous movies, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, will be heavily influenced by the design choices made on films like Dias. While futurist film may have had a short run in Italy, its stylistic echoes would be felt in movies for decades, even as they changed with the future that they would help shape. And with the decline of this first or second, but we don't really need to be counting, art movement, it seems like a good idea to talk about the general decline of the Italian film industry, which, in the middle of the decade, was riding high, both critically and commercially, on the wings of movies like Cabiria, Bovadas, Julius Caesar, The Last Days of Pompeii, the Machiste movies, and the Diva films. But that ride was about to come to an end. In fact, by the middle of the 1910s, Europe seemed like it was about to come to an end. World War I was hard on everyone and everything. In addition to grinding millions of lives into the ground, both into trenches and into pieces, it would also grind much of Europe's non-essential markets to a halt. You can't survive without food, and you won't win a war without bullets, but you don't really need movies. To further exacerbate this problem, any movies made in Italy pretty much could only be shown in Italy, because the world's largest war was going on, and one half of Europe was now cut off from the other half as far as trade was concerned. But aside from Armageddon happening, there were also other reasons the Italian film market shrank during and after World War I. As we've already mentioned at the beginning of the episode, the Italian studios lacked central organizing principles which they all shared. This would eventually limit the amount of movies the studios could produce. In an all-too-familiar story, the factory was simply able to outcompete the artisanal workshop. It was just as true for movies as it is for rocking chairs. After the war, a flood of foreign films, mostly from the United States and Germany, would control the now drooping Italian market, further decreasing demand for domestic film made in Italy. Aside from those economic factors, there were also, like, filmmaking factors. According to Jacqueline Reich, Italian filmmakers actively resisted advancements in editing that were being explored in places like the United States, Germany, and the newly formed Soviet Union. While the whole rest of the world moved towards the new future of filmmaking, many Italian filmmakers remained rooted to more traditional forms of filmmaking, to their detriment. Added to that, most of the Italian filmmakers who were going to be prominent throughout the silent era after World War I went to where the money was, and they worked as filmmakers in places like Germany or the United States. And on top of all of that, there was a shortage of raw film stock in Italy at the time. They literally couldn't make films because there was no film to film the film on. Take all of these factors together and you have a recipe for a decline and a fall of a mighty international film empire. Italian film production dropped from 371 movies produced in 1920 to 66 in 1924 to 8 in 1930. You heard me right. 8. In 10 years, Italian film production dropped 98%. In decades to come, the tradition of Italian filmmakers and Italian film would again become one of the most important and prestigious in the world. But Italy would never become an economic superpower in world cinema again. And so, the dreams of buku billions from Italian cinema would end. But Italy's place in film history was just beginning. We'll be back many, many times. But not so next week. No, next week takes us back once again to America, where we will finally be introduced to the most talked about man who made the most talked about film in the 1910s. On Monday, we will have our first episode on the life, work, and unfortunate influence of one David Wark Griffith. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The History of Film. It was a many-headed hydra of a subject, but I hope you enjoyed learning about all of these pieces of Italian film history as much as I did. My favorite fact that didn't make it into the show was about the 1920 film starring Francesca Bertini called The Serpent. I haven't found a way to actually watch the movie, but I have read the plot. It's about a budding romance between a man and a woman, but the romance is given sinister overtones as it is intercut with a snake torturing and killing its prey. Here is the thing. For the life of me, I can't find out which one of them is supposed to be the snake. The snake could be either one of them, and I may never know because I can't find the movie. I haven't even found a truly detailed explanation of the plot and visuals. I like to assume that Francesca Bertini is the classic femme fatale, and so she is the scary snake, but unfortunately, I don't know. If you would like to email me, you can contact me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com. I always appreciate your emails. You can also visit the show's website, which is going to be overhauled over the next couple weeks to be more interesting and useful to all of you. The show's web address is historyoffilmpodcast.com. If you're new here, please subscribe for more new film history every week, and leave a review of the show in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. That's the most important thing you can do to help the show grow, and it also helps me know what you like about it. Thank you for listening, and join me next week for another exciting episode of The History of Film.